So that'll just be the nature of it. Now, if there's a unique, if we're going through a section where I can do more discussion, I will send that out in the weekly newsletter. I won't try to do a separate email. We got too many people. I'll blast it out in the weekly newsletter on Monday. And again, don't know how many weeks this will be. I said on Sunday it would be 2 to 8. I can guarantee it will not be 2. It will be more than that. I think it'll be, I don't know. We'll just see how it goes. So it really just depends on the interest level and discussion and that sort of thing when it's open to it. So my disclaimer, what I've given you is kind of an outline of my own notes. I got the facilitator's version that they gave me here. So I'm just going to read a brief disclaimer. I think it's important that you all hear this before we dive in. How dare you? Oh, man. All right, so here's my disclaimer. Lots of what we'll be discussing is non-essential and even at times non-canonical. We will base most of what we're going to do out of the Bible. There will be some speculation, some open to interpretation, and there will be some that will be non-canonical, like meaning it's not in the Bible. It's coming from a different book that's not authoritative scripture, but may be helpful to provide some understanding. So it's not authoritative. I plan to teach, share, promote discussion, and it's okay to disagree on a lot of this stuff. I'm not expecting in any way that we're all going to agree on this stuff. It's not meant to be, so the goal is not to have points of contention, but rather we're to look at some things that are very rarely discussed in the church. This used to be a passion, a hobby, a strong interest of mine, and that was many years ago. It's not as fresh on my mind as it was 10 years ago. I suspect, just to set expectations real low, that I will not teach it satisfactory to everybody. It will not be as thorough as it could be. It will not be as apologetic, perhaps, as somebody would want. Sometimes I'm just going to teach it the way I see it or the way I understand it without going into very lengthy proofs. There are going to be some conclusions that I'm going to share that could take me an hour to tell you why this is it or why I see it this way, that we're just not going to spend an hour to make such a small point. However, if there's anything as we go that you have questions or you want more on, you want to say, how do you come to that conclusion? I'm happy to connect with you outside of this time and share with you maybe some of my own notes or resources that can help you see, spend a little time on why I'm coming to a specific conclusion. Students of the Word are encouraged, as always, to be good Bereans, so study more at home. This is a good one to come on Wednesday and then go home and review lots that we cover, rather than the opposite, like you would normally prepare for discussion. This would be a good one to go home and search the Scriptures and see that what I'm saying is there and legitimate, and do your own research. So all that being said, we're going to use the Bible as the final authority. Speculation, any speculation must be taken as just that, speculation. And I could probably go on and on with this disclaimer, but I think that's enough. So open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. That's where we're going to start. Rachel asked me this morning where we're going to start. I said the beginning. And she asked how far I got. I got 6 pages here. We made it to Genesis 3 this morning, maybe. I think we will. So lots of what we're going to do this morning is laying a foundation, much needed foundation and understanding to be able to continue in the coming weeks. So I'll throw out a non-confrontational or divisive question to start with. How old is the earth? How old is the earth? How old is creation? When did this happen? Very good. I like that answer. I like that answer. All right, somebody, and I don't know who, said I'm a, was it you? You're a, you mean young? You're a young earth, okay? I know we have at least one old earth in here, and I know who he is. Who else? What? Pre-Adamic? I don't know what that word means. You're way too advanced for me. What's pre-Adamic? Antediluvian. Antediluvian is a word that means pre-flood. Obviously, this is pre-flood, but some people believe we have a young earth. Some people we have an old earth. Some people say it's thousands of years old. Some people say it's billions of years old. I'm not going to convince you. I just thought I'd throw it out there and see what your thoughts were. I'm not going to do a study on it. We could do a study on it. Does anybody feel really strongly one way or the other? No? 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 It seemed like if I'm ever going to throw that question out, it's got to happen in this study. I don't know when else we would do this. We're certainly not going to do this when we're covering election. So, both to me are valid. Both have good, you can make solid biblical interpretation to come to either conclusion. I have a leaning, and others have another leaning. And I'm happy to share my perspective some other time. I don't want to create enemies this early. We know that God did it. So if you're looking at Genesis 1, I mean, we can at least look at the very first verse to some of these things are going to be relevant later, and we'll see this. But there's the old earth belief generally says between verse 1 and verse 3 were billions of years. So verse 1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Boom. That's it. There goes. He created the heavens and the earth. And then the rest of creation happens a couple of verses later, verse 3. So then he starts going from there with what we know as the 6 days of creation. But the old earth perspective, position, says there's a break here of some unknown amount of time, and there's not a definitive yes, there's this several billions of years break, or no, there's not. But that's where it comes from. Is that break right there. Right, yeah. Between 1 and 3. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And there's pros and cons. There's things that are real solid about that argument and things that are wobbly about it and vice versa. Okay. So there's it could be a both and situation. I just thought you were going to have some sort of Islamic contribution to the. No. Oh, very good. No, that's true. Of course, black holes and white holes are theoretical still, but there's something like that that we can see that they come to those conclusions. When were angels created? Tell me where in the Genesis account, what day did he create angels? Quit that. Everybody's frantically reading the first few verses of chapter 1. Well, you won't find it. You won't find it. What'd you say? He created the heavens. See, you would kind of loop it in with verse 1. Okay. Of course, yeah. The main point is that it's just not here in this six-day creation. It was before. Can anybody, without me telling you where it is, think of a reason, even without citing the specific passage or verse, tell me what proof do we have that they exist prior to these 6 days of creation? Or do we? Okay, and where is this? In Job, very good. Yes, in Job. This was Job 38, verses 4 through 7, for those of you who like to take notes. I provided a few passages that I'll be reading through on your handout. This, I don't think, is one of them. I didn't have space. I think I deleted it. Job 38, verses 4 through 7 says this. This is God talking to Job. He says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who determined its measurements? Surely you know, or stretched the line upon it. What were its bases sunk, or what laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy." So this is, the angels are present in joyful worship, watching, witnessing the creation count, and giving God glory for it. So we know from that they're present before all this. They're present at this time. At the very latest we could possibly say they were created is what Quentin said, verse 1, when he created the heavens. Though it doesn't have to be there, that's certainly where they dwell now, but nothing says they were required to dwell there and must have the heavens created in order to be created after that. But that's the latest they could be made, or sometime before, and we just don't get it at all in this. We also know, for sure, from the Genesis account, we know that who's in the garden later? Starts with an S. Ends with Aten. Satan is in the garden, so he's an angel. He was formerly an angel of light. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes, and was not at that time in Genesis chapter 3. So he had already been created, of course, and fallen and all that had happened prior to this time. So that's more evidence that this has already happened. So Genesis, it's important we note, because this is going to be a refrain to remember. Genesis is not an exhaustive account of all that God has ever done or all that God has ever made. It's the story of creation, the creation of our own physical universe, one which is uniquely, which semi-ties into what Jim was saying, one that is uniquely bound by time and space. God is not bound by time and space. His heavens and angels prior to creation were not bound by time and space. Man and the creation of our universe, the one that we rule over, at least on the earth, is bound by time and space. This is a unique piece of creation. So it's important because Genesis is the only authoritative truth that we have concerning the creation account and then other little snippets like the one we just read from Job. So you could say, well, there's a whole lot missing here. There's lots of details that are not included, and that would be absolutely right. There's a seeming infinite amount of detail missing, and all kinds of questions and speculations that God has not seen fit to give us the answers to. However, we do know at least three things. If you're a note taker, write it down. I'll put it on the screen. No, I won't. Number one, he's given us all that we need to know to know him, enjoy him, and live holy lives for his glory. That'd be the most important, maybe the most important statement of this entire study. What he has given us is sufficient. Number two, he's left out a ton of details of this era with multitudes of questions that remain. You could add to that and say, this was intentional. This is by design. God has purposes. God glorifying your good purposes in not revealing everything. And number three, this does not contradict number two, it just complements it. He has seen fit to allude to this time, this era, in other scriptures that are canon, so we cannot simply dismiss it as, well, God doesn't want us to know. Rather, it seems that he does, at least on some level, but this stuff is not essential or central to point number one, knowing God, being able to enjoy him and live holy lives for his glory. So, which one? Number three? Number one or number three? Number three. He has seen fit to allude to this time, this era. So he's given us details about this in other passages, other Old Testament passages, other New Testament passages that have relevance to this whole study that we're going to do. And this antediluvian era, post-flood era, kind of all this chunk of time, we get little snippets of it that are authoritative from other parts of the Bible later on. And so it's not that he's left us nothing, it's that we have to do a little bit of digging and studying and work to get to fill in some of the pieces. And even then, we're going to leave lots of pieces not filled in. God has not seen fit to give us a lot here, but he's given us some, and that's going to be the authoritative basis for lots of this study. It's going to be all these other things that will tie in, not this week. All right. Questions, comments on those three? Agree, disagree? Praise God, yes. Number one is most important. We know he's given us all, he has given us all that we need in order to know him, to enjoy him, and to live holy lives for his glory. Please. Amen. Amen. All right. All right, so there's lots we could discuss. This is not going to be an exposition through the book of Genesis, but to get to where we're going, we do need to exposit at least some of it, or kind of go topic piece by piece, pick out a few things. I just want to note maybe two things here in the creation account, maybe more, at least two. One is, just so we understand, I think if I could take each of you into a room privately and have you recount creation to me, we would retell it differently. Not because we use different Bibles and stuff, but we just kind of, when we read through it, we get in our mind different, slightly different realities. The reality is verse 1, he created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So to begin with, we've got earth. We've got a terrestrial ball and water covering the whole thing. This is a ball, looks like a ball of water from the outside. You see no land. It's just a ball of water, which has its striking similarities to the flood, which we'll connect those later. But this is what it looks like. It just looks like a circle of water. I don't think a lot of us think that way when we think creation, because later it talks about more specific creation on the earth and him calling that landmass, earth, and those sorts of things. And so I think we kind of, I don't know, we're not really sure. If we said, well, he's hovering over the deep, over the waters, what does that mean? We said, well, I don't know. But I know he created the earth on day, you know, whatever. But actually, the ball, terrestrial ball, exists covered by water. That's where we start. And then, in the creation account, essentially what he does is he pulls landmass from under it up. So it's, he causes land to come out of the water, and the waters recede and go into their own special places on the basis of the different elevation and stuff that's being created in, with earth, with land. So this is the way he's creating. This is just the nature of the way he's creating here. And some of this will be important as we go. And then in the rest of the account, in the rest of the Genesis account, I'm not going to go through it all, but I did provide these scriptures on your handout. We see this, quote unquote, according to its kind, repeated over and over again. Genesis chapter 1, verse 11. I'll just read it. It's on your handout. You can look at it if you have, or look on your neighbor if you don't have. It says, "And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seeds, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth." So this is vegetation, seeds, trees, etc., each according to their kind. Genesis 1:21. "So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarms." This is all sea stuff, "according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind." So everything in the sea, everything in the air, according to its kind. We already covered all the vegetation. This is all the sea creatures, all the air. Genesis 1:24 says, "And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind, livestock and creeping things, and the beast of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so." And then each of those refrains is repeated immediately after. So God's saying, let it be. And then the next verse in the passage, if you were reading through Genesis 1, is God actually doing it. And so we get this kind of the same, it's almost a verbatim repetition each of those times. And so it's this, if you're saying, okay, what's something real significant that stands out because God's repeating it over and over throughout this passage, this is the one thing, this is one of the things that's being repeated a lot. It's the thing being repeated the most. And then the next thing might be him saying, and it was good, after each of his creations. But this is repeated more than that. And so this is significant. There was to be no mingling of different species, nothing of different kinds. Each was to be of their own kind. There's this natural order of creation that's to be kept separate, each according to their kind. And then this is emphasized even more directly later in the law, which you could read later on your own, Deuteronomy chapter 22, Leviticus chapter 19. I'll just read, for example, Leviticus 19, verse 19, and then Deuteronomy 22 essentially says the same thing. He says this is the Lord speaking. He says, "You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your cattle breed with a different kind. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seeds, nor shall you wear a garment of cloth made of two kinds of material." And you can get into speculation, certainly in the latter half of that verse, but it's clear, even in the law at the beginning, that the interbreeding of his created animals was strictly forbidden. This is not to happen. And this is going to be very important, maybe next week. We're not going to get into it this week, but it's just very important that for now we see right out the gate in chapter 1 how important this is. Before we've even gotten to the creation of man and God talking about man and the creation of woman and all this, he's very clear right at the onset talking about the importance of each according to their own kind. We need to see that. All right, and what I've put on your handout is kind of just an outline, little headlines for where we're going. So the next one here is life before the fall as we continue. It's probably worth noting in this life before the fall, this is, okay, what was it like for Adam and Eve? What was it like in the garden? What was it like before they fell? And there's all kinds of stuff we could add here. So, I mean, I have no problem opening this up to discussion. What was it like before the fall? Okay? More specific. Okay, yes, more. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah, that was a part of the curse, to bring toil into the work. So there was joyful work, which is like it'll be in heaven. We're going to have purpose, we're going to have work, but the toil, the agony part of it, the curse part of it will be removed, which is unfathomable to us. Even when you work, I love my job, and there's a lot of it that's toil. It's just, that's the way it is. God's made work to be toil. It's a part of the curse. And so it's hard to imagine. The closest would be somebody who loves their job so much and loves every bit of it that there's just, it doesn't feel like toil at all. They just love every second of it, and even that doesn't compare to what it will be like, because there's still toil in there that they're not discerning or comes with seasons or times and stuff like this. But for most of us, this idea of toil and work, that those are linked very close together, even in the garden, as Mary Jane was saying. Anybody else? What was it like? Oscar, no sin yet. Okay. Dale? Okay. More on that. There was a relationship. Mm-hmm. Adam walked with God. So there was this literally walking in through the garden in the cool of the evening, in the shade. I mean, that just, doesn't that sound amazing? If I could just go for a walk, I mean, even in our garden's beautiful back there. If I could just go for a walk with God himself back there and just talk to him. I mean, we can, just not in a literal sense, like in the garden. Elaine? Well, there was Satan, but he hasn't caused sin. The temptation hasn't come yet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know the curse on man and woman. Man is essentially, man is to be head. And the curse on the woman is she's going to want to be head, and so she's going to try to usurp headship in all kinds of ways, practically speaking, and we see that in all of its wickedness all around the world and in our own marriages. And man, who's supposed to be head, does it in a way that's not Christ-like. It's not gracious. He has a tendency to be overpowering or to be forceful or to be ugly or to be graceless. And that's the curse on both of them. And so there's this strife that exists that would not have existed. It would have been this perfect, even in the best moments of marriage, it's hard to imagine you know, long-term sustained perfection, because we just don't have that. We're fallen, sinful people. Well, even, you know, God's wired women. I'm not a woman, but I can comment on this because I know lots of women. God has wired women to have a unique and a special desire for security and for comfort, especially in the home. And there would, huh? Nesting, yes, yes. And he's wired and called the man, the husband, to provide and to meet that need. But most, if you've lived long enough, you've gone through trials and struggle with security and those kinds of comforts, and how are we going to pay our bills, and you lose your job, and those kinds of things that cause this turmoil over comfort and security and provision and food, like you're talking about, those kind of things. I mean, that would just never have existed before. I mean, that's unimaginable. Budgeting just doesn't exist. Okay, yes, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gary, go ahead. And then Quentin.
Very minor, but I kind of envision it as an all-inclusive resort.
Yeah.
Everything is all you want to eat, you want to eat.
Just go pick it right off the tree. Just not the one tree. Quentin. Nature. Uh-huh.
But it was interesting that man, he told man not to crossbreed.
Mm-hmm.
But the animals themselves naturally
Right. Did
what was naturally right.
Right.
And God had met all their needs when man wasn't even around.
Right.
So all the needs of the animals, mm-hmm. God took care of, and the cycle carried on. The same mm-hmm. thing with the food and the trees, providing that it was Adam and Eve didn't go have to handle all the animals and put them in, take care of them. No.
Sure.
Already did that.
Okay, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
We're the only ones that's going to mess it up. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. It's it's interesting and worth noting that pre-fall we were, in essence, we were vegetarian. We didn't eat meat. Now, that is not a statement on how one should live today. Somebody would say, oh, well, you know, because originally in the garden we were vegetarian, so I'm going to be a vegetarian because I think that's best. Well, I don't agree with you, and there's no biblical precedent that agrees with you or exhortation or anything like that. You're sucking that out of this, and that's not there. But the point is, life was different then than it is now, and God has ordained, and he gave animals for food for us later, after the fall. But beforehand, we didn't go after animals and kill animals and eat animals. We lived in harmony, as you were saying, different animals, just like it will be in heaven one day, where the wolf or the lion, depending on your translation, and the sheep, the lamb will coexist, and they'll be fine. So they all ate what? Who can tell me? Plants. Yeah, we see that in the end of chapter 1. That's verses 29 to 30. I believe, where he says, and God said, behold, I've given you, so this is specifically talking to man, mm-hmm. I've given you every plant yielding seed that's on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You have them all for food, and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird, so now we're going beyond man to the heavens, and everything that creeps on earth, everything that has breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And so we were, in essence, vegetarian. I want to be careful with that word because I don't even know how that word is defined these days. So, but we ate stuff that grew out of the ground that God provided. Go ahead, Bob. Yeah, there was no violence. There was nothing like that. There was no dread in animals of us, no dread of us of, you see a grizzly bear, there was nothing like that. All right. Go ahead. 19:19. It seemed like pre-fall, you would say, like he's saying, you would say a cow is a cow, and then later in the law, it got more specific on types of cows, for example, but we're going to see more where you're talking not just types of cows, but like cow and horse, you know, man and bear, you know, that kind of garbage. Terry? Oh. Yeah, Terry? A horse and zebra, yeah. Okay, so, yeah, so there was not, this was to be, not to be done, and then it was done, and we're going to see some of the consequences of it, and then we're going to, the command for it in the law is going to make a lot more sense once we see a lot of what happened pre-flood era. Dale? No. I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Emotions.
Before the fall, because what I consider negative aspects of emotions, like there's no fear, there's no strife, no suffering, pain, shame, unhappiness, because we only have joy and enjoyment with God. Everything was perfect before sin.
Yeah, you could insert everything about heaven in there. The main difference, we've talked about this in the end time study, the main difference between the Garden of Eden and what heaven will be like is that there will not be the opportunity or the potential for another fall. So in the beginning, there was the possibility for sin to enter the world in a fall. That will never happen again in heaven. There will not be another fall, and everything will be the way it's supposed to be for all eternity. Praise God. That's the main difference in the two. Okay. What about Satan here? Let's talk about him. When did he fall? Before what? Read the verse that tells me when he fell. Okay. That's good. Let's start somewhere. Okay. Before he tempted. So it's before Genesis 3. For sure, his fall is before Genesis 3. Is there anywhere that we can conclude it's after this time? Like after this time, but before this time? Or is there not? Could it have happened before the Genesis account entirely? Did it happen somewhere in the Genesis account? I'm not looking for authoritative statements. There's different views here. Okay, anybody else? Probably before, he says. Before the creation of Adam, okay? That's certainly a possibility. It seems like we're all leaning in that direction. Anybody else? Uh-huh. Don't get ahead of me. He doesn't come down. He is thrown down. But yes, yes, he does. So one of the points that Mary Jane made was he's got to have something to come down to. So there had to be an earth created for him to be cast down to, because we're told in Isaiah, which I've provided, we're going to read in a minute. We're told in Jesus' account in Luke, which we're also going to read in a minute, that he was cast down and that Jesus witnessed this event to the earth. And it specifically says to the earth. And so the earth had to be there for him to be cast down to. So this had to be at least post verse 1. Had to be after verse 1, at least. But even then, there wasn't land for him to land on if he was cast down. It would have just been water at that point. So if we say, okay, well, he landed on land, which he doesn't have to land on land, I guess. He's a spirit being. But if we went that way, we would have to say, okay, well, then it had to be post the creation of land, post the separation of the waters and all this. So it had to been somewhere in at least after that. So now we're kind of inching forward in the Genesis 1 narrative of where it has to be after. It's got to be after. Now, the main argument hinges on verse 31, Genesis chapter 1, verse 31. And I'm not endorsing one way or the other. I think I'll say this is the way I would lean. Some say verse 31, and here's what it says. And God, this is after he's created the 6 days, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Now you can say, there's different arguments. There's some that say, okay, that's referring to all of creation. He sees everything that he's made, and it's all good, which means no fall has happened yet of Satan. He's looking on Satan. He's looking on Lucifer, and it's good. And then there's other arguments that say, well, no, this is only talking about the sixth day stuff, so the creation of man, or maybe the stuff that he's just talked about creating in these last 6 days. Maybe he's looking at all these things on these last 6 days that he's made, and that's what he's saying is good. And so it just depends on, well, what does the word everything in that verse mean? God saw everything that he made. And I don't have the answer because the text is not clear on what that word everything means. Is it everything in all of creation that he's ever made, even the unseen things that's not being talked about? Or is it just what's been shared in the Genesis account? And where you fall on that interpretation would dictate where he fell. So either he fell sometime millions or billions of years before all this, or he fell post verse 31, before Genesis 3, verse 1. Somewhere in there. I lean toward the post verse 31, but I'm not, I waver. This is kind of like the young earth, old earth, right? There are very good arguments for both. There's not a really strong, this one just totally seals the deal. Theologians and scholars much wiser and smarter than me that have studied it way more than me come to conclusions on both sides. And so this is one where we exercise grace, but it's a good one to think about. Where is Satan in the narrative, or Lucifer rather? When did he fall? What's that look like? And you've all brought up some really good points. I really like the one that Mary Jane brought up where he had to have somewhere to fall to. That's a good one. Assuming he... Well, it's just a ball of water, at least on the outside. There's arguments for all kinds of stuff. This is not in stuff I'm covering today. I've read just some crazy speculation, and some of this has some basis in non-canonical books, but it just gets so far out there that I'm not going to teach a lot on it. But there's some that believe that the fall of Satan and the angelic rebellion that we're going to talk about in just a few minutes if we have time, all happened billions of years ago. And then there's this spiritual warfare, this war that's been going on in the spiritual realms and the physical realms with this voidless terrestrial ball that involves that, that's been going on for a very long time prior to creation. They get off into some strange stuff that I'm not going to waste our time with, because it's so much speculation. We'll bring up in passing little speculative things like that, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that kind of stuff. That's what I said, I think. Well, I didn't say that, because we're going to cover it later. But yeah, a third of the angels that fell with him. Okay, so Lucifer before his fall, that's the next title. So we looked at life before the fall. We talked about Satan when he fell. His name was Lucifer, not Satan. Those are not interchangeable. Lucifer was his holy angel name, and it has a holy meaning, and Satan is the opposite. Satan means adversary. So he changes his name, and that's not uncommon in the Bible. We see that with Saul and Paul, and we see it with Jacob and Israel, and we see it a few different times. So Lucifer, before his fall, maybe somebody who's really good at pronouncing all these special stones could read. I think I provided it for you. Ezekiel 28, verses 13 to 15. Read these three verses. Somebody, not everybody at once, but somebody volunteer to read that passage. And also, I misspoke. Verse 12 as well. The first part of that verse. Okay, because someone had mentioned beauty already. I don't remember who it was. Was it you? Somebody. This certainly is. This is describing a heavenly realm. This is something not on earth. It appears, and there's more to the story that seems that it is on earth. In the Garden of Eden, in verse 13, you were in Eden, the Garden of God. Let's keep reading further down. I think the next one I titled Lucifer's Fall. Let's read the rest of Ezekiel 28, verses 16 to 18, and then let's talk about what Lucifer was like before his fall. Because even in the description of his fall here in these next three verses, it gives us a little more context of what he was like, what he was doing, what his role or purpose was in heaven. That's what I want to talk about. So if somebody would read Ezekiel 28, verses 16 and 18, I put that on your handout. All right. What was Lucifer, based on these verses, who was Lucifer and what was he doing before his own fall? What was his role? What's it seem like is being described here? Or you could even say what was he? We're told twice, and say it again. A guardian cherub. Okay, what's a cherub? More specific. It's an angel, but anybody? A cherub? A cherub is this guy, angel. There's different angels, hierarchies, and we could get into. They're in his presence. They're in the throne room with him. There's more that he does here too. What else is going on here? What is he? He's a cherub, so he's a big guy. He's a big. We're told lots of stuff in these two verses that we, in these two passages that we just read about him. Give me some descriptors. Who is he? What's he like? What's he doing? Where is he? Well, then don't. And it's describing a cherub. And he's talking about a cherub and heaven and the Garden of Eden. So, and we can get into that, but it seems and most scholars agree that there's dual, I don't know what the right word is, dual interpretation. God is speaking to two people. He's speaking to Tyre, and he's the king, and he's talking to Lucifer as well. And we see that in Isaiah 14 as well when it's describing the fall of Lucifer. Right, right. The first 8 or 10 verses, whatever it is, are more clearly directed to him. Yeah. There's some kind of transition here in who he's addressing. And this is not uncommon. God does this maybe more frequently than we might think if we were to analyze the scriptures, where he does dual. There's two things going on in whatever it is that's being. We talked in the last study that we did through the War of Gog and Magog. We looked at dual prophecy and dual fulfillment of prophecy. Some that was an ancient fulfillment, and then a future fulfillment that's more completed. Those sorts of things. Similarly, he's speaking to two different ones here. So back on Lucifer. Can anybody give me anything out of these two passages about Lucifer? Okay.
And he wasn't doing it properly.
Okay.
Because he was filled with violence. But his job, he wound up to be trained. So that's not.
Okay, what else? What else? You would be the one to point that out. That's a common interpretation and belief. It's mine as well among scholars, is that he was essentially the worship leader of heaven. He's top dog. He's the most beautiful, the most wise, the most perfect, the most powerful, the most authority. All those words that you can describe that kind of come out of these, that you kind of mine out of these two passages, is who he was. He was the number one, he was second, in command under God himself. He was the number one created being, angelic being in heaven. And so he's a cherub, which denotes, that's the top dog in the hierarchy. He's incredibly powerful. We're specifically told about his wisdom, his perfection, his beauty, and all those things were his undoing. We see this, the stones that you said, which are the exact same ones as the Levitical priests would wear, and so there's some degree of priestly something going on here. Pride, yeah, okay, so then pride snuck in, absolutely, and was his undoing. There's the holy mountain of God, the stones of fire from verse 14 in Ezekiel 28. The stones of fire earlier in Ezekiel, we're told that that's right in front of God. That's in the throne room of God himself. And so he's there with God. So it seems, based on that, that there would be a time where Lucifer was performing some degree of worshiping role, lead worshiping role, in the Garden of Eden prior to his fall. That's what that sounds like. And that's the way I would lean. So there was a time that he existed pre-fall, in the Garden of Eden, not there tempting man or causing problems. It's kind of like Elaine said, it's not before Satan, because Satan was always there. But he wasn't there as Satan. He was there as Lucifer. Anything else on this before we press on? Let's keep going in that same vein. Isaiah 14, I think I gave you this as well, verses 12 and 14. So this is where we see that pride that she's talking about more I mean, it's so overt in this passage. So if somebody else would read, I put it on your handout. This is verses 12 to 14, three verses. Okay. No, that's good. Yeah, perfect. So that's, no, you're good right there. So this is Isaiah 14. This is another same situation where two people are being addressed here, and it's believed by most that this is talking about Satan. There are those that say this has nothing to do with Lucifer, but that's a small minority. So this is what's more famously referred to as the five I wills. He's saying, I will do this, and I will do this, and I'll do that. I'll ascend to heaven. I'll be like God, essentially, is what he's saying. I'll make myself like the Most High, which we see more of that in the temptation of Adam and Eve, and certainly that's pride. Somebody else read 1 Timothy 3:6. This is in the qualifications that Paul is giving for elders. This is one. We're specifically being told of Satan's pride and conceit. What's the qualification? Somebody read that verse.
He must not be a recent convert, or he may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil.
So the devil's condemnation is pride and deceit, it seems. So to summarize, these passages teach that Lucifer became so impressed, see if this rings any bells from recent teachings, became so impressed with his own beauty and intelligence and power and position that he began to desire for himself the honor and the glory that belonged to God alone. Does that sound recent or relevant? Please, somebody tell me where. Romans 1, thank you. Verse 23, they exchange the glory of God for the glory of created things, or for the glory of self, which is exactly what he's doing. And I've said for 2 weeks in a row, this is the sin beneath every other sin. God has exchanged the glory, I mean, God has not. People and Satan here have exchanged the glory of God for the glory of something else, a created something, often self. And in his case, it was his self. This pride represents the actual beginning of sin in the universe, preceding the fall of the human Adam by an indeterminate amount of time. We don't know when this happened. We don't know how long, you could say, how long did Adam and Eve and Satan, how long did all this worship and this priestly, whatever, this priesthood and this coexistence, how long did this happen in the garden before the fall? Could have been centuries. It could have been days. And I think when we read it, depends on how you interpret when they start counting age. If you look at when they got kicked out, it says he knew his wife and had his first son. And it says he was 130 years old when he had his first son. I've always kind of interpreted that they were in the garden for no more than 130 years. Okay. Good. Very good. So there's some amount of time that's passing. We're not told exactly how long. But there's some amount of time here. And what's important about it, and we'll see in just a minute, it's important to know, I don't think it's days. It's not like when you kind of read naturally, it's almost like it just happened immediately. But actually there was this coexistence that happened for some amount of time, which brings a little bit of light to the fall, or the likelihood of the fall, and what tactics that Satan used. Let me see here. I want to comment briefly on Ezekiel 28, verse 17. God says, I cast you to the ground, or another translation, he says, I threw you to the earth. We want to clarify, make sure that this does not mean that Satan had no further access to heaven. We talked about that extensively in the end time study. Job and other Zechariah and a couple other places indicate that he did have access to heaven. He maintained it after his fall. However, he was completely and absolutely cast out of God's heavenly government and of his position of authority. But he was still able to come and go as he pleased, and he still dialogued with God. And we see that very vividly in the account with Job. As Mary Jane, I believe, mentioned earlier, the pre-incarnate Jesus witnessed this event. He tells us in Luke 10, verse 18, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." And so he's there. Jesus wasn't created or born or come into existence in the incarnation. It was just the incarnation. But he existed forever as the pre-incarnate Christ. And so he was there, and he saw this. He saw Satan, Lucifer, fall. Let's see here. We've covered all those things. So we're going to come back to Satan in the garden in just a minute. I want to talk about this angelic rebellion. We've touched on it. I think it was you commenting on what all happened when Satan fell. Was there anything other than Satan falling that happened? Did anybody else fall? Too many people. A third of the angels went with him. Okay, where do we get that? I think I gave you the verses on your handout. If I did, somebody read it. Revelation 12, verse 3 and 4. That's it, yeah. Okay, and another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems, and his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them down to the earth. And stars is frequently referred to as angels. We've already seen this at least a couple of times. I don't remember exactly in which passage. We see Satan was called the morning star. We see stars referred to as multiple angels earlier, and then again here. It's commonly understood that it's a reference to the heavenly host or angelic beings. And then if there was any doubt, John directly connects the dragon to Satan. So we can't say these are different. He connects these two and says they're the same. And then he also specifically connects it to being angels. So we're not speculating now about stars. He specifically tells us in verse 9. I think I put that on your handout as well. If I did, somebody else read chapter 12, verse 9.
"And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him."
Okay, so there's clearly something going on here. There's more than just Satan. There is a third, presumably here, that's what this is telling us, a third that went with him. That means two-thirds remained in heaven, loyal to God, and they are referred to as holy angels. And these are what we would call fallen angels, this one-third that joined Satan. And so now we're seeing the beginnings of two forces that are being developed at this point, and there's going to be war between them, and indeed is still. So, moving quickly here, back to Satan in the garden, kind of, at some point, exactly when and all the nuances, we've kind of talked about all we need to talk about, but at some point, Satan fell, he came to earth, he's permitted into the Garden of Eden, both prior to his fall, and certainly after his fall, because at the very beginning of Genesis 3, verse 1, he's there with Adam and Eve, so he's already there. It's also, this gets into a little speculation, and we might come back to this another time, but it's also suggested in a vision and a metaphor from Ezekiel 31, if you were a note taker, maybe you write it down, verse 8 in particular, and then also Daniel 4, that other angelic beings were present in the Garden of Eden. This is a vision, a metaphor, and an interpretation of the vision that seems to indicate there's angelic beings there. Referred to as cedars. Uh-huh, yeah. There was angelic beings with a sword that guarded it when they left, prevent them from coming back. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so we're not told how long life persisted. We don't know exactly how long before the fall in the garden, how long it lasted, but it seems reasonable to conclude that it didn't happen immediately. I know, at least when I was younger, when I would read through this, it sounds like it happened immediately. I mean, I'm just reading through the narrative, this, then this, then this, then this. It just seems like, and don't really understand the passage of time, and we're not given definitively the passage of time in there, but it seems likely for a couple of reasons. The serpent, which is literally translated the snake, is a manifestation of Satan. I mean, we need to be super clear on that. I think we all agree on that, but we need to be super clear on that. This is confirmed by Revelation. Did you just read Revelation 9? Somebody, yeah, Revelation 12, 9. It's confirmed where he says the great dragon, quote, that ancient serpent. So he's linking the dragon and to the serpent, and that, and then he also called it the devil and Satan. And so this is Satan. This is a manifestation of Satan. He has manifested himself, or he has possessed the body of the snake, serpent. And so this is interesting, and this is just food for thought, but here in the garden, he possesses the body of a snake in its pre-fallen form. And so the snake, I know every Bible or children's Bible I've ever read shows a snake kind of curled up in the tree tempting Eve, but that's not likely how it went down. The snake's nature totally changed with the curse. God says, well, let me jump ahead. God says that, we'll come back to it. But the nature totally changed. This is a pre-fall form, and so it's not the same snake that we have today. It didn't slither around on its belly before the fall. It was cursed to slither around on its belly. And so this could have been a snake with legs standing upright. I mean, it's hard to imagine what it was exactly, but chapter 3, verse 1 tells us some identifiers of this serpent. It says that the serpent was more crafty, which that word means deceitful. He was more crafty or deceitful than any other beast of the field that the Lord had made. So there's something unique about this snake. And then furthermore, this is saying why it most likely didn't happen immediately, but took place over time. When the serpent speaks to Eve, these are just some things to make note of. When the serpent speaks to Eve in the same verse, later on in chapter 3, the same verse, verse 1, she's not at all surprised by the serpent. Not like, oh gosh, there's a serpent here, or he's talking. Neither of those two things are surprising her. The fact that it's there, the fact that he's talking. And so it appears, at least on the surface, that she's familiar with this guy. And you could go to speculate, I would endorse this realm of speculation, that she probably had some level of ongoing relationship with him. Now, what that looked like, that's too far to speculate. But there's something here where she's not at all shocked to see this guy and to be having a dialogue with him. And then it seems more likely to me that Satan tempted her over the course of time. It's almost like you would imagine, I'm trying to think of, kidnapping's not a good example, sex trafficking, abuse, all these kinds of things that happen, rape. A lot of time, it's with someone you have a relationship with, and there's trust there. And so they develop, they kind of move in close, they create, you even see this with false teachers in the church, and wolves in sheep's clothing, that kind of stuff. There's a developed relationship that makes you feel safe, makes you feel okay, and then they pounce. And it seems, we're not told exactly how it happened, so I'm not saying that that's what happened, but it seems plausible or possible, just on the nature of her interaction with him, what she did, didn't do. Even more speculation could be, it's noteworthy that this animal is talking, and she's not the least bit, there's no commentary on the fact that this animal is talking. And so it does make you wonder if animals talked, if they had some ability to use language pre-fall that they don't now, that they will later. Certainly we see animals in heaven in the throne room speaking, worshiping, leading worship. And so it just gets it, you know, we're talking about the fall and the ramifications of the fall, and we're talking about stuff that's not really talked about. These are just kind of outliers, but they're still important. The devastation upon all of creation because of sin was, I don't think we can totally imagine it, and won't until later. Terry.
Mm-hmm.
No, we're not told that he ate or did anything like that. It says because your heart was proud, and so then he spills off out of that. He said at some point, he said, you know, in verse 15, he says, until righteousness was found in you. So at some point, unrighteousness came into Satan. He was tempted. It says he was tempted by his own pride. He started to desire his own glory. He wanted to be God. He wanted, those desires were his. And that came from his own self. It didn't come from without. He was created perfect until this time. And more practical specifics on exactly what that looks like aren't given, but we know it's he and he alone is responsible for his sin and his iniquity. Say it again? His demise, yes, absolutely. Okay, the fall. We don't need to spend a lot of time on the fall. The serpent, Satan, tempts Eve, and they succumb to the desire to be like God, just like Satan himself had done before. Both have a desire to be like God. In other words, Romans 1:23. We want to be our own little gods. And then these are the last two things, and we're going to be done. We got about 5 minutes left, so I'll go quickly on these last two things. The way God responds. This is going to set us up for next time and probably leave you on a cliffhanger. Here's how God responds first. God responds with a curse. Genesis 3, verse 14. The Lord said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all the beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life." And so here is where the very nature of the serpent is changing. Everything that we know about snakes is not necessarily how they were created. I'm sure there's similarities, but the very nature of how he squirms around on the ground and eats dust is not how he was originally created, but that's how he is now as a result of this curse. And then there's more to the curse here against man and woman and creation itself. We talked about that kind of toward the beginning, and it's not super relevant for where we're going. The last piece here is how God responds, this prophecy or this promise. And I would say that I think this is one of the most important verses in the entire Bible, certainly one of the most important verses in this study. This will be the basis for lots of where we're going. Here's what God says: "I will put enmity between you and the woman." So who's he talking to? He's talking to Satan. So God just finished cursing Satan, the snake, and he's still talking to him. He says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman." Who's the woman? Eve, or it's understood, mankind, humanity, people, yes. "I'll put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." Now, what's that a prophecy of? Christ? More. How so? Okay. Christ on the cross fulfills what part of this? Christ on the cross is essentially his heel being bruised, and on the cross he destroys Satan. He bruises his head. Okay, so that part of the prophecy has already been fulfilled. What's this part in the middle? Someone read this part in the middle. And between your offspring and her offspring. Now, the first 100 times I read that, I read right through it. But this is one of the most important verses in this study, because we've got to come to the sobering reality that the serpent is going to have offspring. Between your offspring and her offspring. Both of them are going to have offspring, and there's going to be war. And this war began the moment that this God uttered this proclamation in the garden, and it continues to this day. And it reached all kinds of perverse, climactic manifestations that resulted in the flood. And that's where we're going to go next week. But this is the basis for it. There is war, all-out war that's going to happen here. And Satan's going to do all kinds of stuff now as a result of this, because God just gave away his game plan, and now Satan's got a strategy. Okay, I know how I can prevent it from happening. Here's what I need to do, because here's what he said is going to happen, so I just need to make sure this can't happen. So let me work on this. Do what? Yes, yes, and there came the Nephilim, which we'll talk about next time. Sure, either or. That was speculative, but yes, let me. That was, I believe it was Ezekiel 31, verse 8 in particular, and then also Daniel 4. Just Daniel 4? Yeah, yeah. Daniel 4, just Daniel 4, and then Ezekiel 31, verse 8. And those references, we'll get into this, we might touch on that a little bit. Those two passages are talking about pre-flood, pre-flood Nephilim and fallen angel rule over the world, and they're often referred to, these angelic beings are often referred to as cedars. That's what you're going to find in those passages. And if you were to just pull up your lexicon and look for the word cedar, you would see the point that I'm making. Cedars. They're tall as cedars, strong as cedars, on and on about cedars. They use cedars to refer to these beings in these passages, and it's I'm not giving a dogmatic, authoritative interpretation. I'm saying this is an interpretation, and it's somewhat speculative concerning pre-flood era rule domination by these guys. And if there's interest in that specifically, those specific passages, maybe we can dive into that a little more some other time, because there's lots other to cover that's not as speculative. There's a lot more that we can get into that's more definitive. So that's where we're headed. Thank you for your patience and your prayers. We are 1 minute late. Please do keep Rachel and Addie and Elaine and Edith in your prayers. I will close this briefly, and then we can fellowship. Come back next time. Come back Sunday. Come back next week. And feel free to study. Open the Word and dig in, and you kind of see where we've got to. We've got to Genesis 3, and we're going to go from there. So you could start in Genesis 3 and read a few chapters, and you'll be pretty prepared for next time. All right, Heavenly Father, we just thank you so much for the opportunity to study your word. I thank you for my brothers and sisters who want to dig deep and want to know what your word says. We want to know what was going on in the days of Noah, because you tell us that's what it's going to be like when you return. And so we don't want to be caught with our pants down, so to speak. We want to be eyes wide open, reading the signs. We don't want to be caught off guard or surprised by all the things that the world is going to do and is already actively doing. We don't want to be fearful of these things. We just want to be knowledgeable. We want to walk with you with great wisdom and understanding and knowledge. And so I pray that you would illuminate the word to us, even in our own personal study as we go from here, certainly through the rest of this study. I pray that you would be the one to lead. I pray that you would give me, in my preparation and planning, you give me your words the way you want this to be done. And I pray that you would cause your scripture to come alive. I pray that it would be exciting, not just because it's not doctrine and it's a totally different kind of study, but because it's your word and we want to know what it says. So Lord Jesus, we commit our time, we commit our study to you, we commit ourselves to you. We ask that you'd be glorified in the study and in our lives. And we love you so much. It's in your name we pray. Amen.